is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. There are roughly 62.5 million Americans who identify as Hispanic or Latino. According to the Pew Research Center, that's about one in five of us. And that is a fourfold increase since 1980, when Latinos made up just 7% of the American population. Both parties are trying to appeal to those voters and working to make sure more of them get out to vote. Here's Illinois Congressman Chuy Garcia at the DNC this week.
If you don't invite people to participate, oftentimes people won't participate. That certainly has been the case with Latinos in the past. So I'm hoping that of all the fundraising that's been done, a significant amount, an equitable amount will be spent on reaching out to Latinos and Latinas.
Thank you to our partner station, WNIJ, for sharing that tape. Given the significance of the Hispanic vote, we will be spending the rest of the show today on this topic. What are the top issues among Latino voters? How have they been voting in recent elections? And what are politicians doing to appeal to them? Dr. Melita Garza is an associate professor and the Tom and June Netzel Sleeman Scholar in Business Journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. What a fantastic title. Dr. Garza, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for being with us. And we are also joined today by Mike Madrid, co-founder of the Lincoln Project. You've heard of that. He's a Latino GOP consultant and author of the book Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. Mike, welcome to you as well. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to start with you, Mike. So right off the bat, how significant is the Hispanic and Latino vote in the 2024 election cycle?
Well, look, it's extraordinarily significant. It's actually the Latino vote is now going to be larger in terms of size than the margin of victory will be in every single one of the seven main battleground states. It's no longer just this regional isolated ethnic demographic group. We're witnessing triple digit expansions in states like Tennessee, Montana, Arkansas. But in states like Arizona and Nevada, people expect it to be large, significant, and determinative. But it will also be the same in states like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Georgia. So for the first time in 30 years, when people ask, will the Latino vote be determinative in this presidential contest? The answer is yes. Yes, it will be.
What do you understand about that growth? Is it people moving within America? Is it people immigrating from outside? Why is this changing so much?
That's such an important question because it's really foundational to where the Latino vote is heading. Over 80% of Latino growth, population growth, is U.S. born. And the same numbers exist for voter registrants. New voter registrants are overwhelmingly U.S. born. By quite large margins, they are third and now a discernible fourth generation voter. This is an English dominant, often English exclusive voter that is far, far more focused on pocketbook, economic, and affordability issues than sort of the racial, ethnic issues like immigration and border security that tend to stereotype this community. So a dramatic change in who Latino voters are over the past couple of years and where they'll be heading for the next 25 years compared to where Latino voters have been for the past 25 years.
That's fascinating. Dr. Garza, let me bring you into the conversation now. As someone who studies Latin American culture and the media, how do you see what Mike was just talking about there with these political issues, I guess, are on the minds of Hispanic and Latino voters to the extent you can boil that down?
Well, I think I'd like to just take a quick slice of that and point out the issues related to gender, which we've seen play very significantly into voting patterns today. So cutting across that is also education levels. And we know that Hispanic women are much more likely to have a bachelor's degree than Hispanic men. So if we look at the education levels as a proxy for how voting will go, I think we're seeing a similar trend line for Hispanic women as for women as a whole. So what does that mean? So we have 27% of Hispanic women ages 25 to 29 graduating from college in 2021 versus 20% of Hispanic men. So I think the issues related to women are at the fore of this election. And so I think that's pretty significant.
Well, that's interesting. And Mike, I did want to ask you about that. Talk about this gender gap. That is something we're hearing more about, not just among Latino voters, but among Latino voters as well. How do you see the parties addressing issues of Latino men and women separately, I guess, in ways that are successful and might resonate?
Well, the professor is exactly right. It's actually one of the most, I think, fascinating developments that we're witnessing. Latinos have the largest gender gap of any race or ethnicity in the country. And it's directly correlate, as was accurately pointed out, it's directly correlates to the single largest educational divide between any ethnic group in the country. And as a result, assimilation is working both ways. For men, it means a decidedly sharp break towards the Republican Party. And for the Democrats, they're benefiting from Hispanic women attending college at a faster rate and voting more along educational lines. Now, what this means as it grows as a larger share of the pie is a significant movement away from racial and ethnic identity politics towards a more reflective look at a more representative sample of what mainstream Americans are voting, if that's the right term. So the bottom line is it explains in large part why you are seeing a larger share of Latinos moving towards the Republican Party, even while the gender gap gets larger.
And it's tracking, I guess, the story. One of the most we talk a lot about political polarization in this country. One thing it does seem to really be correlated to, though, is, as you've been saying, educational polarization. Right, the high school degree or some college sort of designation that you see on surveys sometimes seems to be trending Republican. The higher educated tends to be trending Democrat. Does that tracking as well is what you're saying?
That is exactly what is happening. But what is also happening as the education divide, this diploma divide, becomes the largest demarcation of political behavior, these Latinos are leaving behind the ethnic and racial identities that had both men and women voting 65, 70% plus for the Democratic Party. As they become third and fourth generation, they're voting more reflective of the overall population, whereas the professor correctly pointed out, they're taking on these qualities of this education divide, meaning we're getting towards a 55-45 split between men and women with the gender gap, and that's not terribly dissimilar from voting patterns. So while the gender gap is becoming a larger feature of Latino voters, the bigger dynamic that is happening is a movement away from racial and ethnic identity voting. And that's why you're seeing this more parity between the two parties in how Latinos are voting.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show, and we are talking about the importance of the Latino vote in the 2024 elections and how it's been changing over time. My guests are Mike Madrid, who is author of Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. He's also a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Also with us, Associate Professor Melita Garza of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Professor Garza, I wonder what you think about what we've been hearing from Mike there, that identity is becoming less salient as the generations go on for Latino voters.
Well, that is actually my area of study, so I'll be very curious to see the empirical research related to that. But I think generally we do know that if you take language as a proxy for quote unquote acculturation or assimilation, we do know that, for example, in news consumption and media consumption, that subsequent generations, especially third generation, tend to be much more likely to be consuming English language news than first generation and immigrants. So given that, it would seem logical, although again, no empirical research that I've done to show that the other perhaps identity issues apart from language may also be lost in that transition. if you're following that argument. I do want to just circle back quickly to the issue of gender, which is we know that women are more likely to turn out to vote than men. So I think that's also something to watch. It's not just that there's a divide between them, but the fact that women are more likely to vote, I think, is something significant.
Well, on that question of who is likely to vote, I want to bring some tape into the program. Earlier this week, our producer, Jose Zepeda, spoke with Silvia Puente, who is president and CEO of the Latino Policy Forum based in Chicago. That group released a report that studied the Latino voting population. And here are some of the stats she gave about Latino voting population in Illinois.
We know that we're about 13% of the Illinois electorate. As a Latino community, we are a young voting population. 30,000 Latinos turn 18 every year in the state of Illinois, and half of the Latino electorate is under 18. But we know that one of the challenges is still getting people to both register to vote and turn out to vote, because regrettably, more than half of Latino eligible voters are not registered or have not voted in recent elections. But if Latinos are registered to vote, about 3 in 4 will turn out to vote.
I should note that Silvia also mentioned that this follows, a broader pattern in the electorate. Younger voters of all races and ethnicities are less likely to turn out to vote. That said, Dr. Garza, with social media platforms like TikTok becoming, you know, a place where a lot of young people get their news primarily, I wonder what they see on those platforms, you know, how that affects their, you know, decision as to whether to vote. Is it driving them to the polls, or could the opposite be happening? Could it be suppressing the vote somehow?
Well, there has been some research done on social media and disinformation. And because more than one study has shown, a recent study has shown that Latinos tend to be much bigger users of social media to get news than non-Hispanic whites and even than African Americans, there is some concern about how much more Latinos are likely to be subject to disinformation. So that is one issue that should be noted. And I'm sorry, what was the rest of your question?
Well, no, I just wonder if it's something where, you know, this the rise of TikTok and other, you know, forms of media like that. I guess one other thing we could talk about is WhatsApp, right? One of the things you are a professor of journalism. One of the ways that people are increasingly getting their news, especially for people who are non-English speakers, both Spanish or other languages as well, are apps like WhatsApp, which have channels that are pretty invisible to those of us who are not in those groups. But this is a pretty major information source, right?
Right. Again, so WhatsApp in particular is one of the social media apps that Latinos are more likely to be using than any of the other groups. And some of the studies have shown that Latinos are having these political conversations within these WhatsApp dynamics. So that is really quite different. So I'm, you know, curious how the political parties are going to be or are working to reach Latino voters, given that their consumption patterns are a little bit different than the dominant culture, if you will. And so I'm not sure that a one-size-fits-all approach or just translating things into Spanish, which again, there's only a certain percentage of Latinos that are getting their news in Spanish. But I think we're also missing sort of a bigger issue in the whole kind of news dynamic. And that is that just like the rest of the people in the United States, Latinos are also consuming less news. And so that's pretty worrisome, I think, for the media outlets themselves. And in particular, we're seeing substantial declines in viewership of network news, whether it's in English or Spanish. And a lot of the issues related to moving to social media concern inability to monetize news programming. So it's not just a question of where are they getting their news, but the quality of news and whether the news organizations can come up with sustainable methods of giving credible, vetted information over these social media platforms that don't allow easily, or that the companies haven't figured out how to make money off of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, don't get me started on that. That's maybe another topic. But Mike Madrid, how about that? How are political campaigns trying to navigate, or, you know, people in general who are interested in reaching voters, as the Lincoln Project is? How do you navigate this fragmented landscape?
Well, look, there's no question it's becoming much more difficult. But let me speak first to the broader question of civic engagement, because I think it speaks directly to one of the challenges that we have as a community. The first is to recognize that low voter turnout has characterized our population, the Latino population, since decades before social media. So it's not a social media phenomenon. It's not a social media problem. And I would argue it's not even a voter contact problem, although that's part of it. The real demographic explanation for why this is happening consistently, multi-generationally, is there are very significant pockets of poverty that have become stubborn in our country. That's just the reality a lot of politicians don't want to talk about. And we know that there's a correlation between poverty and the lack of civic engagement generally and voting specifically. In states like mine, California, the largest Latino, populated state in the country, we have a million different ways to vote. We've got a million different processes and outreach programs to actually vote, but we have some of the lowest voter turnout rates in the entire country. And a lot of this is because we've got some of the largest, most persistent poverty rates. So until we start looking, rather stop looking at some of these marginal things on kind of the periphery as to what's causing this, when the elephant in the room is that our policies have created this stubborn inability to help people rise economically, we're harming the underpinnings of our democracy. The more people are lost to multi-generational poverty, the more we are seeing fewer and fewer voters in less and less representative districts.
Yeah.
And it's all right. Serious. We've got to take seriously.
All right. We need to take a break. We are going to continue this conversation when we return. You can join us 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of the show today, we are talking with Mike Madrid, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, a Latino GOP consultant and author of Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. Also, Melita Garza, an associate professor in business journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And we are talking about the importance of the Latino voting bloc in American politics, how it has changed over time, what the political parties are doing to try to appeal to such voters, and all of the issues related to that. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455, especially if you are Latino or Hispanic. What are your top issues this year? Do you feel like one party or another better represents you? And if you're not Latino, what do you think about the power of this growing voting bloc? 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Mike, one of the things we were talking about before the show today among my fellow producers is, this idea that we use the term Latino as a catch-all, but there are a lot of different Latino communities, right? I used to cover the General Assembly. I have memories of this one particularly vicious fight between Democrats of Mexican heritage on one hand and Puerto Rican background on the other that was at least as fierce as their fights with Republicans over this at that time. Talk about how the parties deal with and fail to deal with, or maybe you don't even think they should be, if, as you know, we're progressing through generations, this multiplicity of identities that we sort of categorize with the blanket term Latino or Hispanic.
That's such a great question. Let me provide some perspective here. Of the millions of Latinos in this country, a population which is obviously growing faster at a faster rate than any other, 60%, a little over 60% are of Mexican-American heritage descendancy. And it's not that that is so big, although it is, it's that every other group is so small. No other group reaches double digits. Puerto Ricans are about 9%. El Salvadorians and Cubans come in at about 6%. And then Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and on and on in the mid to low single digits. So it's sort of this Mexicanization of the country is really what the Latinization is all about. And while the differences aren't necessarily as big as they are with non-Latinos, there are some very significant gradations. The most obvious and visible and notable exception, of course, being Cuban Americans, whose politics tends to be very, very different because their diaspora, at least in its origin story, began here as political refugees fleeing communism. It seems Venezuelans seem to be following that same trajectory. Virtually every other group came here as economic refugees and began their political trajectories as Democrats. Puerto Ricans, of course, are Americans by birth. So there is probably a little bit too much of an overemphasis on those differences. Countries of origin certainly do matter, but not nearly as much as other demographic criteria, as the professor was pointing out. Generationally, there are far greater differences between this wide swath of Americans than countries of origin, for example. Gender and education levels are increasingly playing a more determinative role than countries of origin. So while we are not monolithic, as they say, a lot of these variances rely on bigger demographic plates shifting than simply country of origin.
Melita Garza, I wonder if you have a perspective on that or what Mike was saying before the break about entrenched poverty.
Well, just on the country of origin, I do want to note that the United States, as it's currently called, is the country of origin for many people of Mexican American background, as we were here before there was this United States, right? And we know that nearly one third of the United States was once part of Mexico. So I think some of the discourse around, who is American and who has the right to be here, it comes from some true misunderstandings of history, or just not even misunderstanding, but just lack of accurate information, things that have been glossed over in the history of our country, right? So I just wanted to get that out there because, Mike is from California. And so we have important cities called San Francisco and Los Angeles and Santa Barbara. My family from Mexico settled in San Antonio during the Mexican Revolution. So refugees as well, political refugees as well. So we have cities like San Antonio, right? And many Spanish-speaking influences. And as we know, even in Florida, which has been dominated by Cuban politics, we have the San Agustin, Florida, which is of course the oldest continuous settlement in the in what is now the United States. It was founded by the Spanish. So I think overlooking this history is an issue in terms of identity. And I just wanted to get that out there. So I think so one of the reasons why the sort of Mexican culture, if you will, or Mexican American culture has dominated this quote unquote identity issue of being a Latino or a Latinx or whatever term you want to use is because simply of that history.
Let me remind listeners again, this is the 21st show. We're talking about the voting patterns of Hispanic and Latino voters and the effect they could have this November with Dr. Melita Garza from the U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and Mike Madrid, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, author of the book Latino Century, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Mike, I want to play one more piece of tape from Sylvia Puente of the Latino Policy Forum. This is what she had to say about how the parties could be selling the right to vote.
I actually think there's more of a sentiment of people in the community voting for those they can't. And I think that's a real way to engage, especially younger Latino voters who are US citizens, to be able to vote for their family members, their neighbors, their community members who are not eligible to vote because they're not citizens. I don't think that that message has been elevated enough to really encourage, especially as I mentioned, our younger voters, those recently that turned 18. I don't think that message has been elevated enough to encourage them to vote for those and speak for those that can't vote for themselves.
Mike Madrid, what do you make of that?
I mean, I don't believe that at all, and there's no evidence that suggests this from quantitative or qualitative data. And I say that because, unfortunately, we often rely on a stereotype of who we are. This kind of sentiment suggests that while noble and virtuous, and I think it's a great quality to have, doesn't reflect the reality that the overwhelming majority of Latinos are focused on inflationary housing, affordability, economic, and jobs issues, and they have been for 30 years. And this unfortunate need to characterize us as the immigrant is wholly inaccurate. And it's time we started talking to Latino voters where they're at. And I don't mean to dismiss or disrespect the nobility or the virtue of what is being espoused, but it's this knee-jerk need to kind of caricaturize who Latinos are when the overwhelming evidence suggests that Latinos are telling us what they want to hear to be engaged. And we have this need to speak to our community like it's an agreed niche group. It's not. The way you get people engaged is by listening to them. And they're telling us overwhelmingly what issues they want to hear about. And rather than accept that and do that, we start reverting back to these ideas of the immigrant story, which, while a beautiful story I'm very proud of, is not at all reflective of what, again, these voters are screaming at us, telling us, and have been for decades now.
Mike, where do you see that problem playing out as the political parties? I mean, are do you see
Yeah.
Republicans or Democrats? Yeah, talk about that. Go ahead.
They're both doing it. And that's the problem, is there's this such a strong need in the American political system to kind of caricaturize non-white people in one way. And the immigrant experience has become definitive for Latinos at this point in time. But again, this is not the overwhelmingly both parties speak when you talk about Latino issues. If you look at Latino polling, there's just a new poll out today from Axios showing it's not even a top 10 issue. The immigration issue. And yet, all of the media, all of the politicians, all of the quote unquote leaders in the community keep referring to this issue and saying this is the way you engage voters. It's quantifiably not accurate. And both parties do this. Like I said, it's not just the Democratic Party, which is struggling with changing some of its language right now as they're losing more and more Latino voters because of an overemphasis on this issue. And Republicans, for their part, have both picked up on it in very bad, dysfunctional ways, as I think Donald Trump personally exemplifies by stoking racist, nativist fears to increase white voter turnout. Or in the reverse, as the Republicans did with the 2012 autopsy after Mitt Romney lost, accept that narrative and say we need to start focusing more on these issues, which are shrinking they're a small share anyway. The immigrant experience, the naturalized voter, is a small share of our community. It's a small share of our electorate, and it's shrinking very quickly. As was pointed in the introduction, 30% or 30,000 Latinos in Illinois are turning 18 every year. This is overwhelmingly a US-born constituency. Again, increasingly third and fourth generation. And the refusal to speak to these voters, where they're clearly demonstrably telling us they want to, I think is one of the most unfortunate realities in American politics today.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation we had on the show a couple of years ago with Kevin Pang, who writes for the New York Times, and he had a book out, and he's of Asian American ancestry, and talked about the difficulty of figuring out how to fit into the American political conversation, which is so dominated by this frame of black and white. And Melita Garza, I wonder if any of that resonates with you, either what Kevin talked about this to the extent you're familiar with it or how I've characterized it, and what Mike Madrid has been saying about the sort of dominant frame of American politics and how, you know, maybe there needs to be new thinking about how to appeal to Latino voters within that context.
So this is a great question, and I think that Mike Madrid's point is well taken. And I have to say that there is a certain aspect of the way news is generated that feeds this misimpression of the immigrant as the dominant image of Latinos, and that has to do with the concept of the idea of news as a deviation from the norm, right? And so sometimes people are shocked to learn that, in fact, most people of Latin background in the United States are actually in the country legally. So I think that not only within the frame of the immigrant, there the frame is the illegal, the person who is here illegally. So I think this is some sort of kind of mea culpa on the part of the media as far as that goes. I think also to your point about Kevin Pang, who also worked for the Chicago Tribune as I did in years past, I think the whole idea of the binary, it's very, it seems to be, it's either one thing or the other, but there can't be anything in between. And of course, the complexity of the Latino dynamic is that Latin people can be of Asian background and Black background and all kinds of different Arab Latinos, et cetera. And this seems to be the whole richness and the diversity of that seems to be lost. But another point that Mike made that I want to go back to, and at the risk of perhaps raising a naive idea, this whole low income issue, I think, is right on the mark. And Mike, I'd like to know, do you think that if we had a national holiday for voting, that that would in any way help mobilize more people from lower income backgrounds to work? Or what might be some solutions to this?
And I have to say,
Comment
we have
below.
just about a minute left in our time together. So, Mike, if you can speak quickly to that, please.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm supportive of all of these reform efforts to try to increase civic participation. But what I don't want us to do is take our eye off the ball, that the real way to do this is to demand that politicians in both parties enact a Latino economic agenda to start addressing the main problem affecting civic participation, which is a lack of ownership and commitment to our society because people don't have any ownership in it. So that's why I was so excited by Kamala Harris's housing plan, is there's literally an attempt to reach out to younger voters and saying, how do we get you on the path of upward economic mobility, get you into home ownership, start you to building generational wealth so that you feel ownership in a society? That's how you get people to participate. That's how you get people to vote.
What a fascinating conversation. Mike Madrid, Melita Garza, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
One quick correction. I said Kevin Pang. Apologies to Kevin. He's great. We've had him on the show as well, but I was actually thinking of J. Caspian Kang, is the author who was formerly with the New York Times, who wrote the book. You can find that conversation on our website, as well as all of our past programs there at 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Welcome aboard. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.